Okay, welcome back. Hour number two. Glad to have you along with us tonight as we talk to Joseph Foster again. Just a remarkable. I guess we call you a historian now, right?
By default, that's what I'm becoming.
Yeah, well, that's good. Living history.
It's fascinating. The deeper you dig, the more you find, and it opens up more questions and more answers. I mean, it's like unraveling that ball of string.
Right.
There's not a day that goes by that I don't learn something new that is related to all this stuff that we're talking about.
That's fascinating. Tell me, I had an email from one of our great friends out there. He said, please ask Joe about Bell Labs and 5G. Any connection? Not that there needs to be, but they were the pioneers in fiber optics and so forth. And 5G is a logical extension of all of that. But 5G clearly has a very dark side to it. No question. You understand that.
Yes, absolutely. Now, funny you should mention it. Everybody knows the modern cell phone was an analog system that was invented by Motorola back in, I guess, the late 70s, early 80s.
Right.
And then AT&T is the one that actually had a team that was put together, Bell Labs, and they came up with what was called Digital Amp, D-Amp.
Okay.
And that is really the modern PCS. So the new technology was based upon digital, not the analog now.
Right.
The unfortunate thing, I know this empirically because I know the guy that headed up the team for AT&T, a gentleman named Jesse Russell, and he is arguably known as the father of the modern cell phone. And he headed up a team for Bell Labs. He worked up in Murray Hill. That team came up with the solution that they use. And I'm going to get a little bit out of my element here. TDMA is the direction that AT&T headed off in with their cellular technology. The rest of the world kind of gravitated to CDMA. And CDMA became more or less the default, the de facto default of the direction that the industry was going to be heading off in. So AT&T had to kind of play catch up because in order to get over to CDMA, they had, and then become wireless CDMA, they had to go and do some intermediary steps. And they lost a lot of time. And meanwhile, the rest of the people, Ericsson and so on, were heading off in the other direction. So that brought us to 2G and 3G finally. Now, as you go further out, they're into the WCDMA. And then that is going to jump into, I believe, another realm. And that's where you're at now with that 5G. And you're right. It is very dark because of the capabilities that it has. First of all, you're no longer going to need those massive cell towers, you know, with a footprint of like 3.5 miles. You know, the footprint gets smaller and smaller the further up you go.
Right.
Okay. So with a small footprint, now of what they're doing, and Verizon, I believe, is the first one to do it. They're putting antennas on telephone poles.
Oh, they're everywhere.
And if they own the telephone poles, they internalize the costs, and they're lighting up the footprint underneath.
Right.
And, of course, it's going to give them the access to the voice data and video, which is the selling point. The downside, and again, I don't know all the particulars, but it gives a lot of insight and access into people's homes. I mean, privacy is dead. I mean, you can...
Oh, no, this is total control. Total domination, total information.
Oh, yeah. All your devices are going to be smart.
They're
smart
all ratting
devices.
Ratting us out, as they say, ratting us out.
Exactly.
They're spying on us. Now, the other issue is, and I've been told this by several people now, that they are so smart that this next gen of 5G phones, each phone will actually act as a mini repeater for a certain area, maybe 100 yards, 200 yards around it, where it'll be rebroadcasting, picking up and rebroadcasting the general traffic. So they've got the modular idea is not just on top of a telephone pole or a church steeple. We're talking about cell phones themselves being the actual network of broadcast towers in miniature.
Right, exactly. Well, I mean, right now, even with your 4G phones, they could be activated remotely. The cameras can be operated remotely.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
The microphones can be operated remotely. You know, so I mean, like I said, privacy is dead. Sometimes you almost say, "Gee, I can't wait for the sunspot activity to wipe it all out. We can get a little privacy back again."
That
is true. I mean, it's the trade-off for all this. You know, and you look at, I mean, you know, you look at the younger generations and everything. They cannot exist without that smartphone in their hand.
The addiction is withering.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't chance. No chance.
That's right.
And the mind control
and everything.
Oh, yes. And they're so far down the road from where we commonly understand. This program is, most of our listeners get it. They're way down the road. They know so much about how the human mind works and what to do to seed it, preempt it, control it, co-opt it. Whatever you want to say, they can do it. And it's being done.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's a sad state that we're in. I mean, I'm not sure how we got here.
No, it's not our fault. We didn't know. We were addicted to television. Then we were addicted to the smartphone. And, I mean, we are younger people. They're brought up with it now. No one reads anymore. The attention span has been reduced to seconds in many cases.
Right.
The nutritional aspect of the human body is gone. It's gone.
Yeah. But to what end? I mean, if you're very cynical, I am. There's somebody that's got a plan going right now, and it's right on track.
Well, they want to reduce the world population by 70-75% for openers. They're going to do it, and they're going to get rich in the process.
Yeah.
Cancer, they make almost $1 million per cancer patient now. It's crazy.
Yeah, yeah. But you're right. I mean, it's all for a reason, and depopulation is unfortunately in scope.
Right. Right. It's on the way.
I mean, how it's going to be done.
Well, it's happening right now. You're seeing it's kind of a slow burn. This generation will not live as long as its parents. The one out of two people with cancer soon will be one out of one. They will not allow cancer cures to be released. They'll continue to obfuscate, hide, and destroy them because there's no money in curing cancer. This is all in treatments.
Right.
And the treatments are gothic. They're middle-aged. They're medieval horrors. That's why 85% of most oncologists won't go near chemo or radiation. They know it doesn't work. Anyway, it's all, that's not Bell Labs, but go ahead with your story.
One would hope. No, I mean, you know, but even there, any type of technological breakthrough, there's an upside and a downside to it. You can take the most, you know, benign thing, and some people are going to figure out a way to turn it into something bad. You know, it's just the nature of the animal. Maybe it's human nature. You know, I'm not sure about that.
There are genetic tendencies that are violent. There's certainly cruelty. We're conditioned to it to a large degree, but we are born with it. It's hormonal, testosterone. Cavemen with clubs kill the animals. The women didn't do it. They'd bring the kill home. The women would prepare it. There's a lot of hormones. There's a lot going on that's a genetically based profile of a whole species. We soon will not be the number one species on the planet. AI will take over. It's just a matter of time. It's going to get loose.
And that will be our downfall because it will eliminate the need for the human.
Interaction
will not be needed.
Right, AI will laugh. They don't die. They live forever. They're not subject to disease. Mm-hmm. They don't have to eat GMOs and herbicides and pesticides, and they're not. They're just not vulnerable to all the things we are. Therefore, they are the dominant life force. Life in quotes. Intelligence on the planet. We're weak, drooling, carbon-based garbage. That's how AI will begin to look at it, if it isn't already looking at it that way. And
you have somebody like Elon Musk. Elon Musk, I mean, he said within 5 years, what did he say, 5 years, will be functionally obsolete because of the AI taking over everything. Will become so reliant.
He's correct. It's that fast. And I think he's right. Yeah. I think he's a jerk, but I think he's right. And there are others who have warned about it as well. And we're warning right here about it. What can we do about it? Nothing, except stay informed, try to insulate ourselves as much as we can from these horribly addictive digital technologies. It's just bad news.
Let me ask you, how much do you think is coming out of controlling units such as, say, the Bilderbergers? Or the
Bilderbergers and the CFR, those are, to me, only the visible tentacles of a much darker, more evil beast that is hiding in the shadows and doesn't stick its head out, not very often. That's the visually accessible part of it all. But there's so much more to it. And I think a lot of it is tied into off-planet, which is on-planet intelligence. Some of it is benign. Some of it is evil. Just depends on apparently what you want. We've got a lot of trouble here. What else can I say? And I don't see any resolution to it except individual survival, prepare, try to make each day a good day. Each day is a blessing. That's an old saying I've always believed in. And if you've got children, you've got to try your darndest to keep them away from peer ruination, which is what's going on. The enforcement of the rules of our sociology is being done by us. Peer pressure.
Yeah.
I'm unique. I have a tattoo.
Driven.
Oh,
no,
really? Uh-huh. Yeah. Tattoos are unique? I don't think so. Never seen a more conformist group in my life.
Right. You're right. Well, you know, that is true, too. So, the whole thing is that we do conform. We are a herd type of animal. You know, even those of us who like to think that we're a little bit more independent than the average person, you know, we still tend to, you know, at the worst possible time, act as part of the herd, a herd, you know, right, wrong, or otherwise.
It does tend to run that way with most people. And now the conditioning is that be even more of a certainty. The controllers have this thing planned. They've been planning this for 100, 200 years. They knew where it was going. They know about how to take charge. They know where it's going to end up, and it's not going to end up in a happy place.
Well, maybe that's where, you know, hope springs eternal. And, you know, I think believing that there is something out there besides us, and that they are visiting us, that they are looking at us, they are observing us.
Well, the day the earth stood still, right?
They're going to look out for us. Yeah.
The day, that's the only, in my view, that kind of an ultimatum is the only thing that could potentially reverse a lot of this, this horror. Never should we have cracked the atom. Never. Biggest mistake of all. Splitting the atom.
Yeah.
Unnecessary. A catastrophe. Fukushima, Three Mile Island, Chernobyl, those are just the ones we know about. And this is not going to go away. That's the problem.
But you know the upside of it? When you make a mistake, it's up to you to learn from that mistake. Hopefully it's not too late. And hopefully enough people are going to say, wait a minute, before we start throwing all of our eggs into this basket here, and we end up with another Fukushima, you know, let's think about this. There are other things out there. You know, we know that they're out there. We know that things have been taken off the shelf because they're out there. And at that point in time, you know, if there's enough pressure, perhaps, then they'll make it available to us again. Or give us a chance to have something that will get us advancing in a positive way, where we become part of a solution as opposed to part of the problem.
Well, I agree.
Right now, we're all part of the problem. I mean,
sure we are. Yeah.
Look at our politics.
Musk has a point. Once the pendulum swings to AI, it's going to take a long time for it to ever come back. We're going to be second class. AI will, once it's loose, there's no stopping it. No, no, that's why you don't hear about it in the news. Yeah, go ahead.
Exactly. Well, the Terminator trilogy, it doesn't get more accurate than that.
You know, I need to go back and look at those films. I think you're right.
It's scary because that's Skynet. I spent 6 weeks out in the Mojave Desert back in the 90s looking at digitizing everything and how to integrate, in Intel into, operational weapon systems and things like that. Putting that AI on top of that is all that is needed. And putting it, having a ring of satellites to control everything like that is definitely in scope. The technology is already there. I'm just hoping that the technology has not been proliferated up there and that it's being used that way. Now, since we're back to some type of a bipolar world, what we do is going to be in reaction to or because of the other side. And there's where we get ourselves in trouble, because now you get that spiral. It's a death spiral.
Right.
Because if it gets to the point where AI is going to control every aspect of our lives, including, the things that are going to really, the sword of Damocles is over our head.
Exactly.
So it truly is.
What the talk is now, they, the scientists, are trying to teach AI common sense. And I've said this many times, but I'll repeat it again. Who's common sense? Right?
Yeah. Well, like everybody knows, there is no such thing as common sense.
So there you go. Once AI is empowered, there will be a threshold, and after that threshold, it will step away and be on its own, and there's nothing we're going to be able to do about it. That's what Elon Musk is saying.
The prime directive is, it's going to clean up. It's going to take care of nuisances. It's going to,
make things efficient.
Originally, what its programming was, and expand it. So. Well, so much. We could really get down in the weeds on this stuff. Hopefully, there are enough people that are thinking about these issues, and that ethics is not dead. And ethical thought is not dead, and that the wiser heads are going to prevail. My concern is the oligarchy that really is in charge. Do they give a a hoot about that? Probably not.
I don't
think
so. No, they only care about their own needs and wants and greed. How much is too much? Apparently, for these people, you can't have too much.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, look at these guys. They're all, hey, I'm going to build my own spaceship, and I'm going to land on the moon, and I'm going to do this, that, and the other thing. How much of that is ego? I'm going to say probably about 90% of it is ego. Are they going to make money with it? Yeah, maybe they will. But the whole thing is ego. I mean, just like how Facebook is being used now. I mean, it's the command and control. It's out of our realm of control.
I agree. So, what do your friends say about this? What do your friends say about this?
Well, specifically,
your circle of
what we're
friends.
Talking about right now?
Yeah. Or how many of those people get it?
Generally speaking, most of the people I know are very conservative. But I also think that they self-edit to the point where if it's something really that you don't want to think about, if you don't think about it, it'll go away. And I think there's a certain amount of that aspect. Now, sometimes you have to face the reality of the world you live in. And either accept it or, what's the prayer? Give me the strength to change that what I can and accept that what I can't. But you can't just go blindly along and say, well, it doesn't impact me. I can take a vacation. I can get in my car and drive, go to a movie or something like that. A lot of people, I think that's what their main motivation is, those simple things in life. And they probably feel that they just have no control about the other stuff. so they're not going to worry about it.
Well, are we not on
I think that's human nature.
We are pretty much on the other side of, remember the me generation? Me.
Mm-hmm.
We're at the logical, not the end stage, but we're at the logical state and the de-evolution of individuality and proactive life with the me and the self. And it's not, I just wish I could say I see a way out of it. I don't. Technology is arrayed against us. It's in everything. Smart dust is a fact. We are being seeded with smart dust, which will interact with 5G. Count on it. It'll be, you inhale it, you drink it, you eat it. It doesn't matter. It'll go in your system. It'll stay there.
Yep.
And it'll react.
Yep.
Little sending and receiving nano stations, self-replicating, self-repairing. So, yeah, that's where we are.
Well, you know, you could look at it this way. I mean, I really try to say something good is going to happen. Something good is going to come out of all this. We may not see it ourselves, but, you know, at some point in time, either it's going to take a turn to the good or it's going to become totally bad. But then that's what's in the cards. You know, we're getting basically what we deserved.
It's called karma, and
Yeah. So
okay.
You accept it, you know, be happy, live for today.
Golden rule, right? That's what we should worry about. Back in a minute with Joe Foster. Welcome back, talking with Joseph Foster. If you would, reload the homepage at Rents and look in guests, look under Joseph's name. And I've just put something together in the last half an hour and zipped it up there for you. And I think you'll enjoy seeing it. So look under Joseph's name. It should be the fourth link. Let's see. Not there yet. All right. Well, maybe it'll show up. Okay. Anyway, I'll let you know if it does. All right. Go ahead, Joe.
Okay. Yeah, I guess we kind of digressed, didn't we? We were talking about Bell Labs. Did you want me to get back to that a little bit? Or
go to Monmouth now. Or we have some other things to cover.
Okay.
So.
Oh, Fort Monmouth?
Yeah. Whatever you want to do.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, let's go to the Project Diana topic. First of all, that was, for me, it was another one of those real eye-openers. Living around this area and even working at Fort Monmouth for a number of years, I was never aware of what went on at the Evans area, which is in Wall Township. There they have what we have now is a 60-foot dish antenna. That was the original antenna that brought down the first Tyros satellite image of a storm. Okay, that was in 1959, I believe. And that was, first of all, let's back up. Project Diana was the first signal that was bounced off of the moon back in 1946. That was an important date because it was arguably the birth of the space age. If you could not get a radio signal into space, you would not be able to communicate with spacecraft. When we finally got men into space, you would not be able to communicate with them. So what you had to do, you had to prove that you could get a certain frequency through the ionosphere. That was done, again, 1946 by the Project Diana antenna. Now, from there, a number of interesting things. They were able to measure the distance accurately to the moon. They were also able to get the speed of the moon as it orbited around the Earth. two very important concepts. So when that happened, it was done for a couple of reasons. First of all, I think it was back in the 1890s, I believe Tesla received some type of radio signals from space. Or they didn't know where the signals originated from.
He didn't.
They don't
even
know exactly. Yeah. Well, apparently the signals may have been pulsars. Okay, that's what the story is now from the astrophysicists. So they also knew back in like 1915, 1920 that radio signals had certain capabilities, but they didn't know exactly how they worked. Like they would bounce off of things. So that was really the birth of radar, was back around 1920. But again, everybody claims first. The Russians claim that they bounced the signal off the moon first. I think the Bulgarians claimed it. Somebody else may have claimed it. The problem was it was never documented. The first time it was documented was when it was done by the Project Diana site and the folks at Fort Monmouth. So now that antenna, the original antenna, is no longer there, but we're doing the same thing. I'm actually bouncing signals off the moon using the 60-foot dish antenna that received the first Tyros transmission. It was also used, before we had satellites, it was used to gather intel. It was a spy device, basically, because it was picking up signals that were being bounced off the moon. They were able to gather them in and use them for a period of time until satellite technology took over for that. So the first image that was taken from Tyros was a hurricane, and they printed it out in Fort Monmouth. And they flew it by helicopter down to President Eisenhower, and he saw that first image. So that was another first. The satellites, the first satellite, U.S. satellite, was actually made by Fort Monmouth, the Explorer. It went up on Vanguard. And that is actually the that melon-sized device is still in orbit today. So there's a lot of firsts. There's a lot of interest. We had an international consortium of engineers, computer engineers, spent 4 days there, and they were taking all the tours and everything like
that.
So
it's
really interesting, because also in 1951-52, it was Fort Monmouth radar that was tracking the UFOs that went to Project Sign, I guess. There was a two-week period, and one of the radar operators was Ed Asner. He was actually stationed at Fort Monmouth. And was it a radar operator there that corroborated the story as well? So it's kind of interesting that, and the way they work very closely with the Project Paperclip scientists and engineers. Interesting little story there. The 56 or so paperclip people that were there, the way they organized them with security and everything else like that, they had basically a security guy on each group monitoring what they were doing and everything else. Now, how long that went on, I'm not exactly sure, but I got that from one of the engineers that is part of the InfoAge group that I'm part of.
Got it.
Fascinating history. Hopefully we're capturing it all, because once these stories are gone, you know, they're going to be gone if they weren't documented. So
that's
the point right now.
Got it. Now, are you at your computer?
Yes, I am.
All right. Go to your name in guests and click on your name.
Okay.
And for everyone listening, just go to guests at Rents and click on Joe's name, Joseph Foster. It's a link now. We've got that linked. Got it?
I'm just getting my browser up right now.
Okay. Yeah, at any rate, for all of you out there,
go to guests.
Yeah, go to guests and click on Joseph Foster. That's a link now. I'll also put it down below as a separate link. And just put together some things I thought were appropriate, given the discussion we're having, that will help people with their perspective. These are pictures from the Hubble Space Telescope. And I just wanted all of you to see that, because we do forget what's up there. And some of these pictures are They're all real. They don't look real. They are real. They're absolutely staggering. So hopefully you'll be able to pull those up, Joe. Just click on your name, and they'll come right up. And just keep in mind that every little dot of light you see is either a sun or a solar system. And then these are galactic pictures. And they are incredible.
Okay, I'm having a little problem getting there. Let's see.
Turn left at the next corner. Go down two blocks. Turn right. Park the car. Get out and go in to the Starbucks and order. And you'll find it.
Okay. I see. So, I'm
just click on your name.
Okay, got it. Yep, got it. Okay. Yes, and I'm seeing. Okay, I'm seeing the galaxy there.
There's a bunch of them.
All right.
And the title is.
Yes.
There are actually people who believe we are alone in the universe. And if you just scroll down and look at these enormous, gigantic galaxies, these stunning pictures from Hubble, that's what's out there.
Exactly.
As far as the eye can see, and then God only knows how much further. Infinity. Look at those pictures.
Beautiful. The coloring, interesting story. There's a woman that works for NASA that actually does the coloration on these things.
Uh-huh. There's a contrast scale they use to assign color values to them. And it's very interesting. But look at these things.
Yep.
I mean, come on. What's going on here?
And with that radio telescope, we can actually look at these galaxies. We can actually, what we do, it's tuned to the 21 centimeter, which is hydrogen. And what we're seeing is actually the hydrogen molecules and how active they are. But you can actually, with Doppler shift and everything, you can see the edge of the galaxy that's going away from you. And, you know, with a different Doppler shift, you can see the galaxy coming towards you and actually interpret what you see on the screen. It's a fascinating subject.
Yeah. Those pictures, though, and it, as deep as Hubble goes, it's more of the same. It's endless. They've come to nowhere near an end, obviously. It's forever. That's where the word infinity came from. And my God, how many galaxies are there? Millions? How many stars are there? Trillions?
No, the galaxies are in the tens of billions.
There you go.
Tens of billions, just the galaxies. Just the galaxies.
So I put five up just for fun.
The other interesting thing, what they've just recently discovered, they've discovered all these galaxies that are traveling away from us, and they're actually picking up speed. So now all of a sudden they're sitting there scratching their head because what they're seeing is an indication that these things are actually going faster than the speed of light. And of course, physics says you can't do that. So, you know, they have all these mysteries that they're trying to resolve.
And I got another.
The head of the.
Go ahead. Finish, Joe. Go ahead.
Yeah, the head of Princeton University. Princeton is the one that got our antenna back online. They use it for their graduate students, but they also are using it for some experimentation as well.
Uh-huh.
Matter of fact, they're using it with Brookhaven National Lab right now, doing things with satellites. So the antenna is live, and I'm lucky to be able to have a chance to sit down and bring it online and, you know, demonstrate the various things that it can do, including bouncing the signals off the moon.
Right. I just got some more data from Frank that you had sent in. There's a map with some points of interest and a gala opening.
Yeah.
Hampton's Drive-In Theater, things like that. I won't be able to get those up tonight, but they'll go up tomorrow under your name.
Okay, well, I can explain basically what they are. The one with the crop circle in the map, that is the farm that I lived on where we had the UFO sighting. The UFO sighting was in 1958. But the crop circle showed up in 2002.
On your farm?
Okay. On the farm that I lived on, yep, absolutely. So, and then the other interesting thing, I had a couple of other things out there. There's another map that shows 1970 Nike landing map.
Yep.
You see that one?
Yep.
Okay, open that one up. And this is in 1970, if you look in the star to the left, there was a UFO landing there. And there it is, how close it is to that Navy pier. Uh-huh. And then there's New York 53, is a Nike site that blew up, killing 10 men.
Yeah.
Okay. The site on the upper right, which is where I give the tours, New York 56, we had 24 nuclear-armed Nike Hercules missiles there. 1970, the only time, and that the launch section chief said the only time in the 5 years that he was there that they actually armed those nuclear missiles for flight, you know, armed the warheads,
right,
was in 1970, the summer of 1970, the same time that the UFO landings took place. Now, the interesting thing is because it was a nuclear installation, it's compartmentalized, and they follow the protocols. So if you work in the launcher area, you don't know what's going on at the IFC. They only tell you what you need to know to do your job. They were told that there was a single Tu-95 bear bomber that they got the whole launch section ready to fire at. Now, you're not going to fire a nuclear missile at a single bomber. They would have been taken out by a fighter plane.
Mm-hmm.
Now, even after the threat disappeared, it was an hour and a half before they stood down. It's unprecedented. Now, I've been doing this for about 5 years, and I know the Nike guys, the guys that were actually stationed there, stationed at other sites, and it's taken 5 years for them to start opening up about their UFO incidents with their batteries.
Wow.
So,
very
interesting. And again, yeah, it's some people take, there was one Nike Ajax guy at a site in North Jersey. He said there's something that happened that he cannot talk about to this day. The guy's probably in his 80s, and he cannot talk about it to this day. It was non-nuclear, so it was not a nuclear protocol issue. It was an operational issue. There was something that happened, and apparently a lot of these sites, they pick up UFOs, they're tracking them. In the early 50s, there was a major or a lieutenant colonel that drafted a memo suggesting that they use Nike Ajax to shoot down UFOs. So, you know, I mean, this is all—it's all loosely tied together. It's anecdotal because you know the hard and fast evidence is very hard to come by. But the anecdotal stories, knowing what I know about the area and the understanding the relationship between Bell Labs, Fort Monmouth, the Nike sites, Navy Pier, nuclear weapons, and all the other stuff that you know is talked about ad infinitum about in relationship to UFOs, we have here at the microcosm. And that landing was actually verified by the police chief in Middletown. I'm from Middletown. I've lived in Middletown, as did my wife. My wife's grandfather was a deputy police chief in Middletown at the time that the Nike site blew up. Okay, which was 1958.
Mm-hmm.
The same within 2 months of when I had my UFO sighting along that same Navy road.
Do we suspect some connectivity there?
To me, it's more than suspect. It's just that can I grab all the data together? I can show you the article from the newspaper, the local newspaper, about the UFO landing, the sighting and the landing. A mile and a half away from
the
Navy.
So they blew up the Nike base? Is that what you're thinking? To teach us a lesson?
No. The official story, which everybody talks about, was that they were doing safety upgrades to the missiles. Unfortunately, the safety upgrades were being done when these missiles were fully fueled with what they call a devil's glove of fuel.
Yeah.
And the warheads were there and everything else. So
liquid fuel, Highly volatile nuclear warheads, and they're going to do safety upgrades at the same time?
Well, no, no. These were the Nike Ajax. They were conventional warhead only.
Oh,
but
okay.
The whole launch section went up. It was a chain reaction.
The Hercules
one of them
had
actually,
the nukes.
Hercules was new. We only had Hercules nukes out at Sandy Hook, Gateway National Park now, which is where New York 56 is. They were all nukes. With the smallest was 5 kiloton. The medium-sized warheads were 20 kiloton, size of the bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima. And then the large was twice that. It was a 40 kiloton that the Navy used originally for their their early ballistic missiles, submarine-launched ballistic missiles.
This would have, had they ever launched those, can you imagine that many nuclear blasts going off in the... wouldn't have been the upper atmosphere, would have been the medium atmosphere, probably. 20,000, 30,000 feet, something like that?
Well, actually, the Hercules, their ceiling was about 110,000, 120,000 feet. So, I mean, they can get up there high enough. They also had a range of about 95 to 100 miles, and they could be used in a ballistic capability
We're talking about highly visible explosions.
Mm-hmm.
Right overhead,
oh, yeah,
basically.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. The rationale was that the Tu-95 bear bomber could carry two of the largest nuclear devices ever set off, which was 57 megaton. The fireball was 8 miles in diameter.
Yeah, that's the Tsar Bomba.
Tsar Bomba, that's right. And they can carry two of those. So, you know, the object was you needed a standoff weapon to stop the aircraft from getting close enough where their explosion could be set off. So,
that would have done it.
So the smaller ones. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the smaller ones were, you know, that was something else.
Think about
but
that.
But even to the point, now Fort Monmouth participated in the International Geophysical Year. And that was 1958. Right? 1958, we also had 100 and some different explosions. The Russians, the Americans, the British, the French, everybody was setting off their bombs during that period of time. I think what it was is to pull to bring the phenomenon out into the open more, where it could be studied by scientists in some type of a controlled environment. So, again, 57, October of 57, Sputnik went up. The nuclear weapons were being detonated, and all of a sudden, UFOs were all over the place. And, you know, for a period of time there, the U.S. military acknowledged them. They acknowledged pilots who saw them.
Right.
And then from 55, 56 on, they took an entirely different tack on the subject, ridiculing it, poo-pooing it, saying that they weren't going to study anyway, which is garbage. I mean, they've been studying it. It's just like the Tic Tac. Jack Sarafati was doing a lot of investigation and the science that he's putting into it, the equations
right.
and everything for the...
Right.
Frank's been working with them.
It's an interesting sighting, but I wonder why they pulled something out of their warehouse of sightings and video that was so old.
Yeah.
They didn't really stick their necks out with that exactly.
Well, it's funny because that was actually reported a number of years ago.
It's an old sighting.
That was out there in the... public domain. It was an old sighting, exactly. And I think what they did is that, first of all, most of the time the pilots, they play it cool. They don't want to get the reputation of being, unhinged, if you will. So they keep it to themselves. But these guys didn't. You know, they felt that they were getting out or whatever, and they didn't have to keep it quiet. But the Navy has been studying. The Navy's had... The Navy and the Air Force have had instructions in place since day one, since 1952. You know, it's the JANUPS reporting mechanism.
Oh, it goes way back.
So, it goes way back, and that's the reason, and it's not disclosure. The unfortunate thing is, a lot of people were thinking it was going to be real disclosure.
Thank you, Joe, for saying that.
We're miles
from that. No, that was not disclosure. That was just a little tease. and that's all it was. Mm-hmm. Very little,
a little
frankly.
Safety valve. Yeah,
that's all. Take a little pressure off. Yeah, let the sheep think that more is coming. Whatever they want, we don't care. You got a picture
here
of a drive-in theater too, and some things. And then there's this round building, which looks like a particle accelerator.
Okay, the round building is. When I was a kid, my folks moved around a lot. We lived out in East Hampton. In Bridgehampton, which is a little bit to the west, a couple miles to the west, there was a drive-in movie theater on old 27A, the old Montauk Highway. Mm-hmm. And we were at the theater one night, and all of a sudden, from behind the screen, above the screen, was this real bright point of light making a three zig and a zag. And it disappeared behind the screen, like it was in a flash. Right, it was less than a second, but it your eye registered the motion of it, and it was also in the direction, which is about 25 miles or so from Brookhaven. Now this is in the mid 50s, and Brookhaven has been, and that part of Long Island has been an interesting area, as is Camp Hero, which is a couple miles in the other direction, out towards Montauk Point. And of course, Camp Hero is where, you know, all the rumors of Mark Ultra and, you know, mind control and Philadelphia experiment, all that. So Long Island is just an interesting place, and it has been. I put that out there because it was one of the sightings that I had. And again, it's filed away for future reference, and I just wanted to put those together and tie them logically, that one may have had an impact on the other. The cyclotron. What you're seeing there is the modern cyclotron at Brookhaven.
Not quite
as big as the one in CERN, but that is a powerful one. Matter of fact, about 7 or 8 years ago, when they first fired up the new one that they had there, they weren't sure whether or not they were going to create a mini black hole.
I know. And now they're building one that is... Do you know they're building one now that's 10 times as big as the CERN facility, or more? They're talking about...
Really?
Yes. So maybe they want another chance at the black hole. I don't know. crazy. You've got this white zigzag above the movie theater, the drive-in movie theater screen. I'll have these images put up by tomorrow morning for all of you listening. So you'll be able... We'll call them more... I'll put them up. Maps, drive-in, whatever. Put those up. That's what you saw, huh? That zigzag?
Yeah, exactly. Yep. Now, the Brookhaven, the person that's in charge of the radio telescope that I operate, he's from Princeton University. He's head of the astrophysics department. And he is doing work. He goes once a month. He goes over to the CERN, and he does work over there on the CERN.
Uh-huh.
Interesting guy. Has an interesting, particle beam type of stuff that I guess he's working on or whatever. So,
all right.
But
now,
his toy is the telescope.
I have not had any confirmation from my third hour guest. So, if you would. Just hang out there for a few minutes. Maybe we can do more to fill this next hour. We got more to talk about.
I'll be more than happy.
If you would, that'd be great.
Tells me I talk too much anyway.
No. Wonderful things. So I'm going to pause now, and if the guest is not available, we'll bring Joe back, and we're going to bring him back anyway. But so stay tuned. Maybe we'll continue. And cover. I'd love to talk about this drive-in some more. That's fun stuff. All right.
Okay.
Hold on, Joe, and let's see what happens. Thank you. Appreciate it. All right. We'll be right back. Hold on.